Side 5. Ilium by Dan Simmons, continuing on page 124. Ada looked out at the distant horizon. The rings were visible above them, two milky strings crossing in a pale blue sky. Is that why you kept the four thermskins rather than throwing them in the disposal bin as the servitors told us to do? I didn't know you noticed that I did, said Harmon. He grinned and drank wine. I tried to do it on the sly. I guess I'm not very good at secrets. At least the servitors had already faxed away. As if on cue, a servitor floated over to replenish their drinks. The little spherical machine floated beyond the wall, 800 feet above the red-yellow ground, as its dainty, white-gloved hands poured wine into their glasses. If Harmon hadn't insisted they change into their thermskins and wear them under their clothes before faxing, they might have died. "Good God," cried Demon. "Where are we? What's going on?" There was no fax node pavilion. Code 8849 had brought them straight into darkness and chaos. Wind howled. There was ice underfoot. The four crashed into sharp things with every step they took in the screaming blackness. Even the fax portal had disappeared behind them. "Ada," called Harmon, "the light." Their hoods provided night vision, but none of them had their hoods up at the moment, and there seemed to be no ambient light to magnify in this absolute blackness. "I'm trying to get it on. There." The small flashlight she'd borrowed from Toby poured a thin beam into the night, illuminating an open door rimmed with frost, icicles 3 feet long, frozen waves of ice underfoot. Ada swung the light, and three therm-skinned faces stared back at her, surprise clearly visible on each face. "There's no pavilion," Harmon said aloud. "Every fax node has a pavilion," said Damon. "There can't be a portal without a node pavilion, right?"
"Not in the old days," said Harmon. "There were thousands of private nodes."
"What's he talking about?" shouted Demon. "Let's get out of here."
Ada had swung the light back into the space they'd faxed into. There was no portal. They were in a small room with shelves and counters and walls all covered with ice. Unlike all fax pavilions, there was no fax node code plate pedestal in the center of the room, and that meant there was no way out, no way back. A million flakes of ice danced in the flashlight beam. Beyond the walls, the wind howled.
"Demon, what you said earlier seems to be true now," said Harmon.
"What? What did I say earlier?"
"That we're trapped. Trapped like rats."
Demon blinked, and the flashlight beam moved on to the frosted walls. The wind howled more loudly.
"It sounds like the wind in the dry valley," said Hannah, "but there were no buildings there. Were there?"
"I don't think so," said Harmon. "But I suspect we're still in Antarctica."
"Where?" said Demon, his teeth chattering. "What's Antarctica?"
"The cold place we were at this morning," said Ada. She stepped through the doorway, leaving the others in darkness for a moment. They scrambled to catch up and huddled behind her like goslings.
"There's a hallway here," said Ada. "Watch your step. The floor is under a foot of ice and snow."
The frozen hallway led to a frozen kitchen. The frozen kitchen opened onto a frozen living room with overturned couches drifted with snow. Ada ran her flashlight beam across a wall of windows triple glazed with ice.
"I think I know where we are," whispered Harmon.
"Never mind that," said Hannah. "How do we get out?"
"Wait," said Ada, lowering the flashlight beam to the icy floor so that everyone's faces were illuminated by the bounce light from below.
"I want to know where you think we are."
"According to the story I've heard, the woman I'm hunting for, the Wandering Jew, had a home, a dummy, on Mount Erebus, a volcano in Antarctica."
"In the dry valley?" asked Demon. The young man kept glancing over his shoulders at the darkness behind him. "God, I'm freezing!"
Hannah moved so quickly over the ice toward Demon that he staggered back and almost slipped.
"Silly, you have to put your thermskin hood on," she said. "We all do. We're going to get frostbite if we don't. Plus, we're losing a lot of body heat through our scalp right now." She pulled the green cowl of the thermskin free of his shirt and tugged the hood into place over his head. Everyone hurried to follow suit. "That's better," said Harmon. "I can see now and hear better as well. The suit earphones damp out the wind howl." "You were saying before that this woman had a place on a volcano near the dry valley? Close enough for us to walk to the fax pavilion there?" Harmon gestured helplessly. "I don't know. I'd wondered if that's how she had shown up at the Burning Man, just walked there. But I don't know the geography. It might be 1 mile or 1,000 miles from here." Demon looked at the black iced windows where the wind flexed the shatterproof panes. "I'm not going out there," he said flatly, "not for any reason."
"For once I agree with Demon," said Hannah.
"I don't understand any of this," said Ada. "You said that this woman lived here long ago, lifetimes ago, centuries and centuries. How could she?"
"I don't know," said Harmon.
He borrowed the flashlight from Ada and started walking down the next hallway. He was stopped by what looked to be white bars. While the others watched, he went back into the drifted living room, picked up the heaviest piece of furniture he could pry free of the ice, a heavy table, the legs snapping off as he tugged it free, and walked back to smash the icicles one after the other, battering a path down the snow-filled hallway.
"Where are you going?" called Demon. "What good is it going to do to go down there? No one's been there for 1,000,000 years. We're just going to freeze when..."
Harmon kicked open a door at the end of the hallway. Light poured out, so did heat. The other three moved as quickly as they could across the treacherous surface to join him. Much like the room they had faxed into, this space was windowless and about 20 feet square. But unlike the other room, this one was warm, lighted, and free of snow or ice. And unlike the other room, this one was almost filled with an oval metal machine about 15 feet long. The thing was floating silently 3 feet off the concrete floor, and a force field shimmered like a glass canopy over its top surface. On that surface were 6 indentations with a soft black material lining them. Each indentation was the length of a human body with 2 short grips or controllers near where the hands would be.
"It looks like someone was expecting 2 more of us," whispered Hannah.
"What is it?" said Demon.
"I think it's a Sony."
"Also called an AFV," said Harmon, his own voice hushed.
"What?" said Demon. "What do those words mean?"
"I don't know," said Harmon, "but people in the lost ages used to fly around in them."
He touched the force field. It parted like quicksilver under his fingers, flowed around his hand, swallowed his wrist.
"Careful," said Ada, but Harmon had already lowered himself first onto his knees and then onto his stomach, then prone, and settling into the black material. His head and back rose just slightly above the curved upper surface of the machine.
"It's fine," he said, "comfortable and warm."
That settled it for the others. Ada was the first to crawl onto the craft, stretching out on her stomach and grasping the 2 handle grips.
"Are these controls of some sort?"
"I have no idea," said Harmon, as Hannah and Demon crawled onto the disc and settled into the outer impressions, leaving the 2 rear center depressions empty.
"You don't know how to fly the thing?"
asked Ada, a bit more shrilly this time. "From the books? From your reading?"
Harmon just shook his head.
"Then what are we doing on it?" said Ada.
"Experimenting."
Harmon twisted the top off his right hand grip. There was a single red button there. He pressed it. The wall ahead of them disappeared as if it had been blown out into the Antarctic night. Cold wind and flying snow swept around them in a blinding implosion, as if the air in the room had been sucked out and the storm pulled back in its place.
Harmon opened his mouth to say, "Hang on!" But before he could speak, the Sony leaped out of the room at an impossible velocity, pressing the bottoms of their boots back against metal and making them each cling wildly to the hand grips.
The force field bubble over their heads kept them alive as the Sony, the AFV, the Thing, flew out from the white volcano with its ice-crusted and shattered buildings clinging to its seaward side. The night vision lenses in their thermskin hoods showed them the fir forest along the coast gone back to ice and death. The abandoned, and drifted over robotic equipment along the curve of a bay, and then the White Sea, the frozen sea. The Sunny leveled off about 1,000 feet above that frozen sea and hurtled out away from land. Harmon released one of the hand grips long enough to activate the direction finder on his palm. "Northeast," he said to the others over their suit comms. No one replied. Everyone was clinging and shaking too fiercely to comment on the direction the machine was headed while taking them to their deaths. What Harmon did not say aloud was that if the old maps he had studied were accurate, there was nothing out this direction for thousands of miles, nothing. 10 minutes of flight and the Sony began losing altitude. They had passed beyond the ice and now were flying over black water scattered with icebergs. "What's happening?" said Ada. She hated the quaver in her own voice. "Is this thing out of energy, fuel? Whatever it uses?" "I don't know," said Harmon. The Sony leveled off a mere 100 feet above the water. "Look," called Hannah. She raised a hand from its grip to point ahead of them. Suddenly, the back of something huge, alive, barnacled with age, flesh corrugated tough, broke the cold sea, its mammal heat radiating like throbbing blood in their night vision enhanced sight. A spout of water shot high toward them, and Harmon smelled fish on the fresh air that the force field allowed through. "What?" began Demon. "I think it's called a whale. I think that's how to pronounce it, but I thought it was extinct millennia ago," said Harmon. "Maybe the post-humans brought it back," Ada said over their suit intercoms. "Maybe." They hurtled farther out to sea, always east-northeast, and after a few more minutes of the Sony holding its altitude, the four passengers began relaxing a bit, adapting as humans have done since time immemorial, to a strange new situation. Harmon had rolled on his side and was looking up at the brilliant stars becoming visible between scattered clouds when Ada startled him by shouting, "Look, ahead!" A large iceberg had become visible over the dark horizon, and the Sony was hurtling straight toward it. The machine had flown over or past other icebergs, but none this broad. It stretched sideways for miles like a gleaming blue-white wall in their night vision, and none this tall. It was apparent that the top of the monstrous thing was higher than their current altitude. "What can we do?" asked Ada. Harmon shook his head. He had no idea how fast the Sony was going. None of them had ever traveled faster than a Voynich-pulled droshky. But it was fast enough, he knew, that the impact would destroy them. "Do you have other controls on your hand grip?" asked Hannah. Her voice was strangely calm. "No," said Harmon. "We could jump," said Demon from behind and to the left of Harmon. The Sony tilted a bit as Demon got to his knees and elbows, his head just within the force field bubble. "No," said Harmon, putting the force of command in the syllable. "You wouldn't last 30 seconds in that sea, even if you survived the fall, which you wouldn't. Get down." Demon dropped to his belly again. The Sony did not slow or change course. The face of the iceberg, Harmon guessed that the thing was at least 2 miles across, rushed at them and grew taller. Harmon estimated that it rose at least 300 feet above the water. They would strike it 2/3 of the way down its cold face. "There's nothing we can do?" said Ada, making it more a statement than a question. Harmon pulled his hood off and looked at her. The cold air was not so bad within their force field cockpit. "I don't think so," he said. "I'm sorry." He reached across with his right hand to take her left hand. She swept her thermskin hood off to show him her eyes. She and Harmon interlaced fingers for a few seconds. A few 100 yards before fiery collision, the Sony slowed again and gained altitude. It whisked over the top edge of the iceberg with 10 feet to spare and banked to the right until it was flying south above the icy surface. It slowed more, hovered, and settled onto the surface, snow hissing under its heated underside. Harmon and the others lay where they were for a silent moment, hanging on to the hand grips, not sharing their thoughts. The force field bubble disappeared, and suddenly the terrible cold and wind burned at Harmon's face. He pulled his hood down in a hurry glancing at Ada as she did the same. "We should get off this thing before it decides to take us somewhere else," Hannah said softly on the comm. They scrambled off. The wind shoved them off balance, relented, shoved at them again. Spindrift pelted their outer clothing and hoods. "What now?" whispered Ada. As if in answer, a double row of red infrared beacons winked on, outlining a 10-foot-wide path from the Sony for 100 yards to... nothing. They walked together, holding each other upright in the wind. If the beacon lights had not burned so brightly in their night vision, they would have turned their backs to the wind and been lost in seconds. Lost, until they stepped off the edge of the iceberg somewhere to their right. The path ended in a hole in the iceberg's surface. Steps had been hacked out of the ice and disappeared toward another red glow far below. "Shall we?" said Hannah. "What choice do we have?" asked Demon. The steps were slippery under their street boots, but some sort of climbing rope had been attached to the right wall with metal spikes and loops, and the four clung to the line while descending. Harmon had counted 40 steps when the stairway ended in a wall of ice. No, the steps continued to their right and down, 50 steps this time, then left and down again for 50 more. The whole descent illuminated by spaced infrared cold flares set into the ice. At the bottom of the steps, a corridor led deep into the iceberg, the way illuminated now by green and blue cold flares as well as red. At places, they came to junctions, but one choice was always dark, the other illuminated. Once they climbed along a slowly ascending corridor, another time they descended for 100 feet or more. The bends and junctions and choices became too labyrinthine to keep track. "Someone's expecting us," whispered Hannah. "I'm counting on it," said Ada. They emerged into a broad hall, perhaps 30 feet above, various other entrances dotting the walls and connected by ice stairways. The floor graded to different levels. Heaters on pedestals glowed orange, and there were a variety of light sources spiked into the walls, floors, and ceilings. On one of the low platforms lay what looked to be furry animal hides, cushions, and a low table with bowls of food and pitchers and goblets of drink. The four gathered around the table but looked dubiously at its contents. "It's all right," said a woman's voice behind them. "It's not poisoned." She had emerged from a high ice door near the platform, and now she descended a zigzag of stairs toward them. Harmon had time to notice the woman's hair. Gray-white, an almost unheard-of choice except for a few eccentrics. And her face, lined with wrinkles, just as Demon had said. This woman was old, in a way none of them, except for Demon at the last Burning Man, had ever seen, and the effect unsettled even Harmon with his 99 years. Other than the obvious age, the woman was attractive enough. Her stride was strong, and she wore a commonplace blue tunic top, cord trousers, and solid boots, the one dash of eccentricity being the red wool cape over her shoulders. The cape's cut was complicated, never quite resolving itself into simple folds. As she stepped onto the platform a few feet from them, Harmon noticed the dark metal object in her right hand. As if noticing the device for the first time herself, she raised it toward them. "Do any of you know what this is?" "No," said Demon, Ada, and Hannah in a soft chorus. "Yes," said Harmon, "it's some sort of lost-age weapon." The other three looked at him. They had seen weapons in the Turncloth drama, swords, spears, shields, bows, and arrows, but nothing so machine-like as this blunt black thing. "Correct," said the woman, "this is called a gun, and it only does one thing, it kills." Demon took a step toward the old woman. "Are you going to kill us? Did you bring us all this way to kill us?" The old woman smiled and set the weapon on the table next to a bowl of oranges. "Hello, Demon," she said. "It's nice to see you again, although I'm not sure you'd remember me from our last meeting. You were in a pretty advanced state of inebriation." "I remember you, Savi," said Demon, his tone cool. "And all of you," continued the old woman, "Hannah, Ada, Harmon, welcome. You were very persistent in following clues, Harmon." She sat on the furs, gestured, and one after the other, the four sat around the low table with her. Savi picked up an orange, offered it, and began peeling it with a sharp fingernail when the others declined.
"We haven't met," said Harmon. "How do you know my name? Our names?"
"You've left quite a wake behind you. What is your people's honorific these days?"
"Harmon or
Wake?"
"Hiking far from fax nodes, so the Voyniks have to follow you.
Learning to read. Seeking out the few remaining libraries in the world, including Ada O's."
She nodded in Ada's direction, and the young woman nodded in return.
"How do you know that Voyniks followed me anywhere?" asked Harmon.
"The Voyniks monitor anyone unusual," said Savi.
She separated the orange into segments, put two segments on four linen cloths, and offered them around. All four accepted them this time.
"I monitor you," she finished, looking at Harmon.
"Why?"
Harmon looked at the slices and set the cloth down on the table. "Why spy on me, and how?"
"Two different questions, my young friend."
Harmon had to smile at this. No one who knew him had called him young in a very long time.
"Then answer the first," he said. "Why spy on me?"
Savi finished the second slice of orange and licked her fingers. Harmon noticed Ada studying the older woman with fascination, looking at her wrinkled fingers and age-mottled hands. If Savi noticed the inspection, she ignored it.
"Harmon, may I drop the ur?"
She did not wait for an answer, but went on, "Harmon, right now you are the only human being on Earth out of a population of more than 300,000 souls. The only human being other than me who can read a written language, or who wants to."
"But," began Harmon.
300,000 people?" interrupted Hannah. "There are a million of us. There have always been a million of us."
Savi smiled but shook her head.
"My dear, who told you that there are a million living human beings on the earth today?"
"Why, no one. I mean, everyone knows."
"Precisely," said Savi.
"Everyone knows. But there is no mechanism to count the population."
"But when someone ascends to the rings," continued Hannah, showing her confusion.
"Another child is allowed to be born," finished Savi.
"Yes.
So I have noticed during the last millennium or so. But there is no population of a million of you, far fewer."
"Why would the posts lie to us?" asked Demon.
Savi raised one eyebrow.
"The posts? Ah, yes, the posts. Have you spoken to a post-human recently, Demon Ur?"
Demon must have considered that question rhetorical. He did not answer.
"I have spoken to post-humans," Savi said quietly.
This carried the others into silence. They waited silently. Such an idea was, at least to Harmon and Ada, literally breathtaking.
"But that was a long time ago," the old woman said, speaking so softly that the other leaned closer to hear.
"A long, long time ago. Before the final fax."
Her eyes, a startling gray-blue a second before, now looked clouded, distracted.
Harmon shook his head. "I was the one who heard the story about you, the Wandering Jew, the last of your lost age, but I don't understand. How can you live beyond your 20th?
Ada blinked at Harmon's rudeness, but Savi did not seem to mind.
"First of all, this 100-year lifespan is a relatively recent addition to humankind, my dears. It is something the posts came up with only after the final fax. Only after they botched everything. Our future. The Earth's future. In that disastrous final fax. Only centuries after my 9,113 post-Rubicon fellow humans were faxed into the neutrino system, never to be returned, although the posts promised them they would be. Only after that genocide did your precious post-humans rebuild the core population of your ancestors and come up with this idea of 100 years and a theoretical herd population of a million people."
Savi stopped and took a breath. She was obviously agitated. She took another breath and gestured to the pitchers on the table.
"I have tea here, if you are interested. Or a very strong wine. I am going to take some wine."
She did so, pouring with slightly shaking hands. She gestured to their goblets. Demon shook his head. Anna and Ada took tea. Harmon accepted a goblet of red wine.
"Harmon," she began again, more composed now, "you asked two questions before I digressed from my answer. First, why have I noticed you? Second, how have I survived for so long?
The answer to your first question is that I am interested in what the Voyniks are interested in and alarmed by, and they are interested in and alarmed by your behavior over the past decades. But why would the Voyniks notice or care about me, began Harmon. Savi held up one finger. To your second question, I can say that I stay alive over these past centuries by sleeping much of the time and by hiding when I am awake. When I move, it is either by Sony, you enjoyed a ride in one today, or through walking, hiking between the fax node pavilions. I don't understand, said Ada. How can you hike between fax nodes? Savi stood. The others stood with her. I understand it's been a busy day for you, my young friends, but much lies ahead if you choose to follow me. If not, the Sony will return you to the nearest fax node pavilion in what used to be Africa, I believe. It is your choice. She looked at Demon. Each of you must choose. Hannah drank the last of her tea and set the goblet down. And what are you going to show us if we follow you, Savi-Ur? Many things, my child. But first of all, I will show you how to fly and to visit places you've never heard of, places you've never dreamt of. The four looked at each other. Harmon and Ada nodded to each other, agreeing that they would follow the woman. Hannah said, yes, count me in. Demon seemed to be pondering the choice for a silent moment. Then he said, I'll go, but before I go, I want some of that strong wine after all. Savi filled his goblet. 14. Low Mars Orbit. Nunmut reset his systems and did a quick damage assessment, nothing disabling to either his organic or cybernetic components. The explosion had caused rapid depressurization of 3 forward ballast tanks, but 12 remained intact. He checked internal clocks. He had been unconscious for less than 30 seconds before reset, and he was still connected virtually to his submersible across the usual bandwidths. The Dark Lady was reporting wild tumbling, some minor hull breach, monitoring system overloads, hull temperatures above boiling, and a score of other complaints. But there was nothing that demanded Monmouth's immediate attention. He rebooted video connections, but all he could see was the red-hot glowing interior of the spacecraft's hold, the open bay doors and, through those doors, tumbling starfields. Orfu? There was no response on the common band or on any of the tight beam or maser channels, not even static. The airlock was still open. Monmouth grabbed a personal reaction pack and coils of unbreakable microfilament rope and pulled himself out the airlock doors, fighting the vector forces of the tumbling by grabbing handholds he knew from decades of deep-sea work. On his own hull, he checked that the sub's payload bay doors were fully opened, estimated how much room he would need, and then grabbed some of Koros's carefully folded machines at random and jetted them out of his sub. Out of the disintegrating spacecraft, tumbling away through the blobs of molten ship metal and glowing plasma. Monmouth didn't know if he was jettisoning the weapons of mass destruction that Koros had been planning to bring to the surface. On my ship, thought Monmouth with the same outrage he'd felt earlier. Or if he was jettisoning gear that he would need for survival if he ever reached Mars. At that moment, he didn't care. He needed the space. Tying the rope off to brackets on the Dark Lady's hull, Monmouth jutted out into space, taking care not to collide with the shattered ship bay doors. Once outside, and a safe 100 meters from the tumbling ship, he rotated to get his first view of the damage. It was worse than he'd thought. As Orfu had described, the entire bow of the spacecraft was gone, the control room and everything 10 meters aft of where the control room had been. Sheared off as if it had never existed. Only a glowing and dissipating cloud of plasma around the bow showed where Koros III and Repo had been. The rest of the ship's fuselage had cracked and fragmented. Monmouth could only guess the catastrophic results if the fusion engines, hydrogen tanks, Matlor Fennelly's scoop, and other propulsion devices had not been jettisoned long before this attack. The secondary explosions would certainly have vaporized Orfu and him. Orfu? Monmouth was using radio now as well as tight beam, but the reflector antennae had been slagged off the hull for the maser relay. There was no response.
trying to avoid the flying shrapnel, blobs of glowing metal, and the worst of the expanding plasma cloud while keeping slack in the line so that the tumbling wouldn't fling him around the dying ship. Monmouth used the reaction thrusters to come up and over the hull of the ship. The tumbling was so fierce now, stars, Mars, stars, Mars, that Monmouth had to shut down his eyes and use the pack's radar feed to find his way around the hull. Orpheu was still in his cradle. For a second, Monmouth was joyous. The radar signature showed his friend intact and in place. But then he activated his eyes and saw the carnage. The blast that had sheared off the bow had also scorched and fractured the upper hull of the ship all the way back to Orpheu's position and, as the Ionian had reported, had cracked and blackened his heavy carapace for a third of his length. Orpheu's forward manipulators were gone. His forward comm antennae were missing. His eyes were gone. Cracks ran the last 3 meters of Orpheu's upper shell. "Orpheu," called Monmouth on direct tight beam. Nothing. Using every meg of his computational abilities, Monmouth gauged the vectors involved and jetted over to the upper hull, all 10 jets firing in microbursts to adjust his dangerous trajectory, until he was within a meter of the hull. He pulled the K-tool from the pack's belt and fired a piton into the hull, then looped his line around it, making sure to keep it from getting tangled. He would have to pull free in a minute. Pulling the line tight, swinging like a pendulum arm, Monmouth arced aft to Orpheu's cradle, although scorched crater seemed a better description of the indentation in the hull now. Hanging on to Orpheu's carapace, his short legs swinging wildly above him, Monmouth slapped a hard-line stick-on against his friend's body just aft of where his eyes had been. "Orpheu?"
"Monmouth?"
Orpheu's voice was cracked but strong. Mostly, it was surprised.
"Where are you? How are you reaching me? All my calm is down."
Monmouth felt the kind of joy that only a few of Shakespeare's characters ever achieved.
"I'm in contact with you. Hardline, I'm going to get you out of here."
"That's idiotic,"
boomed the Ionian's voice.
"I'm useless. I don't..."
"Shut up," explained Monmouth. "I have a line. I need to tie you on. Where?"
"There's a tie-on bracket about 2 meters aft of my sensor bundle," said Orpheu.
"No, there isn't." Monmouth hated the idea of firing a piton into Orpheu's body, but he would if he had to.
"Well,"
began Orpheu, and stopped for a terrible few seconds of silence as the extent of his own injuries obviously sank in.
"Aft, then. Farthest from the blast, just above the thruster cluster."
Monmouth didn't tell his friend that the external thrusters were also gone. He kicked back, found the tie-on, and tied the microfilament line with an unbreakable knot. If there was one thing that Moravec Monmouth had in common with the human sailors who had preceded him on Earth's seas for millennia, it was knowing how to tie a good knot.
"Hang on," said Monmouth over the hard line. "I'm going to pull you out. Don't worry if we lose contact. There are a lot of vector forces right now."
"This is insane," cried Orpheu, his voice still scratchy on the hard line. "There's no room in the Dark Lady, and I can't do you any good if you get me there. I don't have anything left to hang on with."
"Quiet," said Monmouth, his voice calm. He added, "My friend..."
Monmouth triggered all the reaction-packed jets, tugging loose the piton line as he did so. The jets got Orpheu up and out of his hull cradle. The tumbling of the ship did the rest, swinging both Moravecs 100 meters out and away from the ship. Delta-V computations clouding his vision field, Mars and stars still exchanging places every 2 seconds, Monmouth let the line go taut and then he fired the thrusters, using up energy at a fearsome rate, matching tumble velocities and railing himself up the long line to the Dark Lady. Orpheu's mass was considerable. Its pull made the worst by the tumbling, but the line was unbreakable, and so was Monmouth's will at the moment. He ratcheted them closer to the open bay of the waiting submersible. The spacecraft began breaking up from the stresses, pieces of the stern snapping off and flying past Monmouth where he clung to Orpheu's carapace. 2 tons of metal missing the smaller Moravec's head by less than 5 meters. Monmouth pulled them in.
It was no use. The ship was coming apart around the Dark Lady, explosions further rending the hull as trace reaction gases and internal pressurized chambers gave way. Monmouth would never get to the sub before it was torn apart. All right, muttered Monmouth, the mountain has to come to Mohammed.
What?
Cried Orfu, sounding alarmed for the first time. Monmouth had forgotten the hard line was still operative. Nothing, hang on.
How can I hang on, my friend? My manipulators and hands are all gone. You hang on to me.
Right, said Monmouth, and fired every thruster he had, using up the pack's energy supplies so quickly that he had to go to emergency reserve. It worked. The Dark Lady emerged from the dark ship's bay only seconds before the belly of the spacecraft began to come apart. Monmouth thrusted further away, seeing blobs of molten metal splatter on Orfu's poor battered carapace. I'm sorry, whispered Monmouth, as he used the last of his fuel to tug the tumbling submersible farther from the dying spaceship.
Sorry for what? Asked Orfu.
Never mind, patted Monmouth. Tell you later.
He tugged, shoved, thrust, and generally Moravec hauled the huge Ionian into the almost empty payload bay. It was better in the darkness of the bay. The wildly spinning stars, planet, no longer gave Monmouth vertigo. He crammed his friend into the main payload niche and activated the adjustable clamps. Orfu was secure now. It was probable that all three of them, the Dark Lady and the two Moraveks, were doomed, but at least they'd end their existence together. Monmouth attached the sub's comm leads to the hardline port. You're safe for now, gasped Monmouth, feeling the organic parts of his body nearing overload. I'm going to cut my hardline comm now.
What?
Began Orfu, but Monmouth had cut the portable line and pulled himself hand over hand to the payload bay airlock. It still cycled. With the last of his strength, he pulled himself up the vacuum-filled internal corridor to the enviro-niche, dogged the hatch but did not pressurize the chamber, connecting to life support lead instead. O2 flowed, calm hissed, static. The ship's systems reported ongoing but survivable damage.
Still there?
Said Monmouth.
Where are you?
In my control room.
What's the status, Monmouth?
The ship's essentially spun itself to bits. The sub's more or less intact, including the stealth wrapping and the thrusters fore and aft. But I don't have any idea how to control them.
Control them?
Then it obviously dawned on Orfu.
You're still going to try to enter Mars' atmosphere?
What choice do we have?
There was a full second or two of silence while Orfu thought about that. Finally he said, I agree.
Do you think you can fly this thing into the atmosphere?
No chance in hell, said Monmouth, sounding almost cheerful. I'm going to download what control software Koros put in and let you fly us in. There came that rumbling, sneezing noise over the hardline, although Monmouth found it very hard to believe that his friend was laughing at this particular moment.
You have to be joking. I'm blind, not just eyes and cameras missing, but my whole optical network burned out. I'm a mess. Essentially, I'm a bit of a brain in a broken basket. Tell me you're joking.
Monmouth downloaded the programming the sub's banks had on the external add-on thrusters. Parachutes, the whole cryptic smash. He activated all the sub's hull cameras, but had to look away. The tumbling was as terrible and vertigo-producing as before. Mars filled the view now. Polar cap, blue sea, polar cap, blue sea. Bit of black space. Polar cap, and watching it made Monmouth sick. There, he said as the download ended, I'll be your eyes. I'll give you whatever navigational data the sub can crib from the reaction software. You get us stabilized and fly us in. This time there was no mistaking the rumbling laughter.
Sure, why not, said Orfu. Hell, the fall alone will kill us.
The rings of thrusters on the Dark Lady began to fire on Orfu's command. 15. The Plains of Ilium. Diomedes, literally driven into battle by war-geared, cloud-cloaked, horse-handling Athena, rushes to attack Ares. I've never seen anything like this. First, Aphrodite is wounded by the enhanced Argive, Tydeus' son.
And now the war god himself has been called to single combat with Diomedes. Aristea with a god. Incredible. Ares, in his usual fashion, had promised Zeus and Athena only this morning that he would help the Greeks, and now, spurred on by the taunts of Apollo and his own treacherous nature, he has begun attacking the Argives without quarter. Minutes ago, the god of war slaughtered Periphas, Orchesius' son, the best fighter the Aetolian contingent of the Greeks had to offer, and is in the act of stripping Periphas naked when he looks up to see the chariot driven by Athena bearing down on him. The goddess herself is hidden now by a stealth cloak of darkness. Ares must know that some god or goddess is driving the chariot, but he does not take time to try to see through the stealth cloud. He is too eager to kill Diomedes. The god strikes first, casting his spear with the accuracy only a god can command. The spear flies up and over the edge of the chariot straight at Diomedes' heart, but Athena reaches out from her cloud of darkness and slaps it aside. For an instant, all Ares can do is stare with incredulity as his god-wrought spear goes flying off to embed its tungsten alloy tip in rocky soil. Now, as the chariot clatters by, it is Diomedes' turn. He leans far out and lunges with his own energy-enhanced bronze spear. Pallas Athena's shared sheath of plank field allows the human weapon to penetrate first the war god's force field, then the war god's ornate belt, then the war god's divine bowels. Ares' scream of pain when it comes makes Aphrodite's earlier world-shaking howl seem a whisper. I remember that Homer described this noise as a shriek, roaring, thundering loud as 9-10,000 combat soldiers when massive armies clash. That, it turns out, is an understatement. For the second time this bloody day, both armies freeze in the grim business of their slaughter out of mortal fear at such divine noise. Even noble Hector, intent now on nothing more noble than hacking his way through Argive flesh to murder the retreating Odysseus, halts his assault and turns his head toward the patch of bloody ground where Ares has been wounded. Diomedes jumps from his Athena-driven chariot to finish the job on Ares, but the war god, still writhing in divine pain, is shifting, growing, changing, losing human form. The air around Diomedes and the other milling Greeks and Trojans fighting over Periphas' now-forgotten corpse is suddenly filled with dirt, debris, bits of cloth and leather, as Ares abandons his god-human shape and becomes something else. Where the tall god Ares had stood a minute before now rises a twisting cyclone of black plasma energy, its static electricity discharging in random lightning bolts which strike Argive and Trojan alike. Diomedes halts his attack and cringes back, his bloodlust temporarily blunted by the cyclone's fury. Then Ares is gone, cutting away with his bowels held in only by his own ichor-bloodied hands, and the battlefield remains almost as frozen as if the gods have stopped time again. But no, the birds still fly, dust still settles, the air still moves. This motionlessness now is awe, nothing more, nothing less. "Have you ever seen anything like that, Hockenberry?" Nightenhelzer's voice startles me. I'd forgotten he was there. "No," I say. We stand in silence a moment until the mortal battle begins anew, until Athena's cloaked form disappears from Diomedes' charging chariot, and then I begin to walk away from the other Skullic. "I'm going to morph and see how the royal family on the walls of Ilium is taking this," I tell Nightenhelzer before disappearing from his sight. I morph all right, but it is only a ruse to cover my real disappearance. Hidden by dust and confusion in the Trojan ranks, I lift Death's helmet over my head and, activating the medallion, QT after the wounded Ares, following his quantum trail through twisted space to Olympus. I emerge from quantum shift, not on the grassy swards of Olympus, nor in the Hall of the Gods, but in some vast space that looks more like the control room of a late 20th century medical clinic than any structure or interior space I've seen on Olympus. There are clusters of gods and other creatures visible in the sterile-looking space, and for a half a minute after phase shifting I hold my breath, yet again, heart pounding as I wait to see if these gods and their minions are able to detect my presence. Evidently not. Ares is on some sort of medical examination table with three humanoid but not quite human entities or constructs hovering around him and offering care. The creatures may be robots, although sleeker and more organic-looking and alien in appearance than any robots dreamt of in my day. And I see that one has started an IV drip while another is passing a glowing ultraviolet ray over Ares' torn belly. The god of war is still holding his guts in with his bloodied hands. Ares looks pained and frightened and angry. He looks, in other words, human. Along the long white wall, giant vats rise 20 feet or more and are filled with a bubbling violet fluid, various umbilicals and filaments, and gods. Tall, tanned, perfect human forms in various stages of what could be either reconstruction or decomposition. I see open organ cavities, white bones, striated red flesh, the sickening flash of bare skull. I don't recognize the other god forms, but in the next to closest tank floats Aphrodite, naked, eyes closed, hair floating, body perfect except for her perfect wrist and hand almost severed from her perfect arm. A roiling cluster of green worms is spiraling around the ligaments and tendons and bones there, either devouring or suturing or both. I look away. Zeus enters the long room and sweeps across the space between medical monitors with no dials, past robots wrapped in what looks to be synthetic flesh, between gods who bow their heads and stand back to honor him. For an instant, the great god's head swivels my way, the startling eyes under gray brows look directly into me, and I know I have been discovered. I wait for the Zeus boom and lightning blast. None comes. Zeus turns away, is he smiling? And stops in front of Ares, who still sits hunched on the examination table between hovering machines and flesh-tending robotic things. Zeus stands in front of the wounded god with his arms crossed, toga draped, head lowered, all trimmed gray beard and untrimmed gray brows, his bare chest radiating bronze light and strength, his expression fierce, more irritated school principal than concerned father, I would say. Ares speaks first. Father Zeus, doesn't it infuriate you to see such human violence, such bloody work? We're the everlasting immortal gods, but goddamn, we suffer injuries and insults. Thanks to our own divine arguments and conflicting wills, every time we show these stinking mortals a bit of kindness. And it's bad enough we have to fight these nano-crazed mortal sons of bitches, Lord Zeus, but we also have to fight you. Ares takes a breath, grimaces in pain, and waits. Zeus says nothing, but continues to glower, as if pondering the war god's words. And Athena, gasps the injured god, you've let that girl go too far, O son of Cronus. Ever since you gave birth to her from your own head, that child of chaos and destruction, you've always let her have her way, never blocked her reckless will. And now she's turned the mortal Diomedes into one of her weapons, spurred him on to ravage against us gods. Ares is excited and furious now. Spittle flies. I can still see the blue-gray coils of his intestines in what appears to be golden blood. First, she incited that mortal to lunge at Aphrodite, stabbing her wrist, spilling her divine blood. The healer's attendants tell me that she'll be in the vat for a full day, recovering. Then Athena spurs on Diomedes to charge me, the god of war. And his nano-augmented body was fast enough that he would have had me in the vats myself for days or weeks, perhaps even to need resurrection, if I hadn't been faster still. If he had taken my heart on his spear point, I'd still be writhing among the human corpses down there, feeling more pain than I do trying to soldier on, but being beaten down by mere mortal bronze, weak as some breathless ghost from our old earth days and...
Enough, bellows Zeus.
And not only stops Ares' diatribe, but freezes every god and robot in the place. I'll hear no more whining prattle from you, Ares, you lying, two-faced, treacherous sparrow fart. You miserable excuse for a man, much less for a god. Ares blinks at this, opens his mouth, but wisely, I think, does not choose to interrupt. Listen to you whining and whimpering here from your little cut, sneers Zeus, unfolding his mighty arms and holding one giant hand out, as if preparing to will the war god out of existence with a command. You,
I hate you most of all the maggots chosen to become gods when it came time for our change, you miserable hypocrite. You coward-hearted lover of death and grim battles and the bloody gristmill of war. You have your mother's meanness, Ares, and her rage. I confess that I can barely keep Hera in her place, especially when she decides on some little pet project close to her heart, such as slaughtering the Achaeans to a man. Ares doubles over as if Zeus's words are hurting him, but I suspect the cause of pain is really the hovering spherical robot thing stitching the lining of his abdomen shut with what looks to be an industrial-strength portable sewing machine. Zeus ignores the ministrations of the medics and paces back and forth, coming within 2 yards of me before turning and walking back to stand in front of the hunched and grimacing Ares. I hope it's your mother's promptings, Hera's urgings, that have made you suffer like this, O god of war. I can hear the godly sarcasm in Zeus's voice. I'd just as soon have you die. Ares looks up in real shock and terror now. Zeus laughs at the war god's expression. You didn't know that we can die? Die beyond that reconstruction or recom resurrection? We can, my son, we can. Ares looks down in confusion. The machine is almost finished tucking the divine bowels back in and stitching up the last of the muscle and flesh. Healer! Booms Zeus, and something tall and very not human emerges from behind the bubbling vats. The thing is more centipede than machine, with multiple arms, each with multiple joints and fly-like red eyes set 15 feet high on its segmented body. Straps and devices and odd organic bits hang from harnesses strung around the healer's giant bug body. You are still my son, Zeus says to the grimacing war god. The Lord of Thunder's voice is softer now. You are my son, as I am Kronos' son. To me, your mother bore you. Ares reaches up his bloodied hand as if to grasp Zeus's forearm, but the older god ignores the gesture. But trust me, Ares, if you had sprung from the seed of another god and still grown into such a shit-eating disappointment, believe me when I say that I'd long since have dropped you into that deep, dark pit below where the Titans writhe to this day. Zeus waves the healer forward and then turns and strides out of the hall. I step back, so do the other gods in attendance, as the giant healer lifts Ares in 5 of its arms, carries him to the empty tank, attaches various fibers and tentacles and umbilicals, and drops him into the bubbling violet liquid. As soon as his face is under the surface, Ares closes his eyes, and the green worms flock out of apertures in the glass and go to work on the war god's ravaged gut. I decide it's time to leave. I am learning the rhythm of quantum teleportation with this medallion device. Clearly picture the place you want to go, and the device QTs you there. I clearly picture my college campus in Indiana in the last years of the 20th century. The device does nothing. Sighing once, I picture the Skolik dormitory at the base of Olympus. The medallion phase shifts me there at once. I blink into existence, although not visibility because of the Hades helmet, just outside the red steps in front of the green doors of the redstone barracks building. It's been a damned long day, and all I want to do is find my bunk, get out of all this gear, and take a nap. Let Neidenhauser report to the muse. As if my thought had summoned her, I see the muse flick into existence just 2 yards from me and swing aside the barracks doors. I'm amazed. The muse has never come to the barracks before. We always ride the crystal elevator to her. Secure in whatever Hades technology conceals me, I follow her into the common room. Harkonberry, she yells in her powerful goddess voice. A young Skolik named Blix, some Homer scholar from the 22nd century who has been assigned the night shift at Ilium, comes from his first floor room, knuckling his eyes and looking stunned. Where is Harkonberry? Demands my muse. Blix shakes his head, his mouth sagging open. He sleeps in boxer shorts and a stained undershirt. Harkonberry! Demands the impatient muse.
Neidenhauser says that he went to Ilium, but he's not there. He hasn't reported to me. Have you seen any of the day shift Skulliks come through here?
No, Goddess, says poor Blix, bowing his head in some sort of approximation of deference.
Go back to bed, the muse says disgustedly.
She strides outside, looks downhill toward the shore where the green men strain, hauling their stone heads from the quarry.
I could follow her trail through phase shift space, but why?
She obviously wants the helmet and the medallion back. With Aphrodite in the vat, I'm a loose cannon to her. It is my bet that besides Aphrodite, only the muse knows that I've been outfitted as a spy with these gadgets. And perhaps even the muse does not know how Aphrodite plans to use me.
To spy on Athena, and then to kill her.
Why? Even if Zeus's harsh words to his son Ares are true, that gods can die the true death, is it possible for a mere mortal to do them in? Diomedes had done his best this day to kill two gods, and did manage to put two of the gods out of action, floating in vats with green worms working on them.
I shake my head. Suddenly I'm very tired and very confused. My effort to defy the gods, only 24 hours old now, has all but ended. Aphrodite will have me terminated by this time tomorrow.
Where to go?
I can't hide from the gods for very long, and if it becomes obvious that I'm trying, Aphrodite will have my guts for garters that much sooner. As soon as the goddess of love is back in action tomorrow, she'll see me, find me. I can QT back to the battlefield below Ilium and allow myself to be found by the muse. It may be my best chance. Even if she appropriates my gear, she will probably allow me to live until Aphrodite is devatted. What do I have to lose?
One day.
Aphrodite will be in the vat for one day, and none of the other gods can see me or find me until she's back.
One day.
Effectively, I have one day left to live. With that in mind, I finally decide where I am going.
16. South Polar Sea. The four travelers decided to eat after all. Savi disappeared into one of her lighted tunnels for a few minutes and returned with warmer dishes. Chicken, heated rice, curried peppers, and strips of grilled lamb. The four had munched on their food in Ulaanbaat hours earlier, but now they ate with enthusiasm.
If you're weary, said Savi, you can sleep here tonight before we head off. There are comfortable sleeping areas in some of the nearby rooms.
Each said he or she was not that tired. It was only late afternoon, Paris crater time.
Demon looked around, swallowed some of the grilled lamb he was chewing, and said, Why do you live in a...
He turned to Harmon. What did you call it?
An iceberg, said Harmon.
Demon nodded and chewed and turned back to Savi. Why do you live in an iceberg?
The woman smiled.
This particular home of mine might be the result of, let's say, an old woman's nostalgia.
When she saw Harmon looking at her intently, she added, I was on a sort of sabbatical in a burg much like this when the final facts went on without me 14 of your allotted lifespans ago.
I thought that everyone was stored during the final facts, said Ada. She wiped her fingers on a beautiful tan linen napkin. All the millions of old-style humans.
Savi shook her head.
Not millions, my dear. There were just a few more than 9,000 of us when the posts carried out their final facts. As far as I can tell, none of those people, many of them my friends, were reconstituted after the hiatus. All of us survivors of the pandemic were Jews, you know, because of our resistance to the Rubicon virus.
What are Jews? Asked Hannah. Or what were Jews?
Mostly a theoretical race construct, said Savi. A semi-distinct genetic group brought about by cultural and religious isolation over several thousand years.
She paused and looked at her four guests. Only Harmon's expression suggested that he might have the slightest clue to what she was talking about.
It doesn't really matter, Savi said softly, but it's why you heard of me referred to as the Wandering Jew, Harmon. I became a myth, a legend. The phrase Wandering Jew survived after the meaning was lost.
She smiled again, but with no visible humor.
How did you miss the final facts? Asked Harmon. Why did the post-humans leave you behind?
I don't know.
I've asked myself that question for centuries. Perhaps so that I could serve as witness.
Witness? Said Ada. To what?
There were many strange changes in heaven and earth in the centuries before and after the final facts, my dear. Perhaps the posts felt that someone, even if just one old-style human being, should bear witness to all these changes.
Many changes? Said Hannah. I don't really understand.
No, my dear, you wouldn't, would you? You and your parents and your parents' parents' parents have known a world that does not seem to change at all, except for some of the individuals, and they're only at a steady pace of a century per person.
No, the changes I'm talking about were not all visible, to be sure.
But this is not the Earth that the original old styles or the early posts once knew.
What's the difference? Asked Demon, his tone showing everyone how little the answer might interest him.
Savi trained her clear gray-blue eyes on him.
For one thing, a small thing to be sure, certainly small when compared to all the others, but important to me nonetheless, there are no other Jews.
She showed them the way to private toilet areas and suggested that they remove their therm skins for the voyage.
Won't we need them? Asked Demon.
It'll be cold getting to the Sony, said Savi, but we'll manage and you won't need them after that.
Ada changed out of her therm skin and was back in the main room on the couch, looking at the ice walls and thinking about all this, when Savi came out of a different side chamber. The older woman was wearing thicker trousers than before, stronger and higher boots, a lined cape, and a cap pulled low, her hair pulled back in a gray ponytail. She was carrying a faded khaki backpack that looked heavy. Ada had never seen a woman dressed quite like this, and was fascinated by the old woman's style. She realized that she was fascinated by Savi in general. Harmon was also fascinated, it seemed, but with the weapon still visible in Savi's belt.
"You're still considering shooting one of us?" he asked.
No, said Savi, at least not right now, but there are other things that may need shooting from time to time.
The walk up and out of the interior and across the surface to the sunny was cold. The wind was still howling and the snow was still pelting, but the machine was warm under its bubble force field. Savi took the front spot that Harmon had occupied during the flight out, and Ada settled into her place on the right, noticing that when Savi passed her hand over the black cowl under the hand grip, a holographic control panel appeared.
"Where did that come from?" asked Harmon from his spot to the left of the old woman. One occupant indentation was still empty between Demon and Hannah.
"It wouldn't have been a good idea for you to try to fly the Sony on your way here," said Savi. She checked to make sure that everyone was settled in and secure in their prone positions. Then she tweaked the hand grip, the machine hummed deeply, and they rose vertically 700 or 800 feet above the ice, did a full inverted loop. The force field kept them pressed in their places, but it felt as if there was nothing but air standing between them and a terrible death falling to the blue ice and black sea so far below. And then the machine righted itself, banked left, and climbed steeply toward the stars.
When the machine was flying northwest at high speed and serious altitude, Harmon said, "Can this take us there?"
He gestured with his left hand, his fingers pressing into the elastic force field above him.
"Where?" said Savi, still concentrating on the holographic displays in front of her. She raised her eyes.
"The P-ring?"
Harmon was almost on his back, staring up at the polar ring moving north to south above them. The tens of thousands of individual components burning startlingly bright in the clear, thin air at this altitude.
"Yes," he said.
Savi shook her head. "This is a Sony, not a spacecraft. The P-ring is high.
Why would you want to go up there?"
Harmon ignored the question.
"Do you know where we could find a spacecraft?"
The old woman smiled again. Watching Savi carefully, Ada was noticing the variety of the woman's expressions. The smiles with real warmth, those with none, and this kind that suggested something actively cold or ironic.
Perhaps, she said, but her tone warned against further questioning. Anna asked, Did you actually meet post-humans?
Yes, said Savi, raising her voice slightly to be heard above the Sony's hum as they hurtled northward.
I actually met some.
What were they like? Anna's voice was slightly wistful.
First off, they were all women, said Savi.
Harmon blinked at this. They were?
Yes. A lot of us suspected that only a few posts ever came down to Earth, but that they used different forms.
All female. Perhaps there were no male post-humans. Perhaps they didn't retain gender as they controlled their own evolution. Who knows?
Did they have names? Asked Demon.
Savi nodded. The one I knew best, well, the one I saw the most, was named Moira.
What were they like? Anna asked again. Their personalities? Their looks?
They preferred floating to walking, Savi said cryptically. They liked to throw parties for us old styles. They tended to speak in Delphic riddles. There was silence for a minute except for the wind rushing over the polycarbon hull and the force field bubble. Finally, Ada said, Did they come down from their rings much?
Safi shook her head again.
Not much. Very rarely toward the end in the last years before the final facts. But it was rumored that they had some installations in the Mediterranean Basin.
Mediterranean Basin? Said Harmon.
Savi smiled, and Ada thought it was one of her amused smiles. 1,000 years before the final facts, the posts drained a sizable sea south of Europe, dammed it up between a rock called Gibraltar and the tip of North Africa, and made it out of bounds for old styles. A lot of it was turned to farmland, so the posts told us. But I did some trespassing there before being discovered and tossed out, and I found that there were... Well, cities might be the best description, if something solid state can be called a city.
Solid state, said Hannah. Never mind, child.
Harmon was prone again on his elbows. He shook his head. I've never heard of this Mediterranean Basin, or Gibraltar, or... When was it, North Africa?
I know you've discovered a few maps, Harmon, and learned how to read them, after a fashion, said Savi. But they were poor maps, and old. The few books that the post-humans allowed to survive to this post-literate age were vague, harmless.
Harmon frowned again. They flew north in silence.
Masoni carried them out of the polar night into afternoon light, away from the dark ocean, and across land at a height they could only guess at, and a speed they could only dream of. The P-ring faded as the sky grew blue, and the E-ring became visible to the north. They crossed land, hidden by tall white clouds, then saw high, snow-covered peaks and glacial valleys far below. Savi swooped the Sony lower, east of the peaks, and they flew 1,000 feet above rainforest and green savannas, still moving so quickly that more peaks appeared like dots above the horizon and then grew into mountains in mere minutes.
Is this South America? Asked Harmon.
It used to be, said Savi.
What does that mean?
It means that the continents have changed quite a bit since any of the maps you've seen were drawn, said the old woman. And they had quite a few more names since then as well. Did the maps you saw show this landmass connected to the one called North America?
Yes.
No more.
She touched the holographic symbols, twisted the hand grip, and the Sony flew lower. Ada rose up on her elbows, hair against the force field bubble, and looked around. Silently, except for the rush of air over their force bubble, the Sony flew just above treetop height. Cycads, giant ferns, ancient leafless trees flicked past. To the west rose the foothills along the line of high peaks. Farther east, rolling grasslands were dotted with more of these primitive trees. Large animals lumbered like mobile boulders near the rivers and lakes. Grazing animals with improbable snouts were streaked with white, brown, tan, red. Ada could identify none of them. Suddenly a herd of these grazing animals stampeded past 100 feet beneath the Sony,
all panicked, fleeing for their lives. After them loped half a dozen bird-like creatures, massive, 8 feet tall or taller, Ada guessed, with wild feather plumage flying back from the largest beaks and the ugliest faces Ada had ever seen. The grazing animals were running fast, 30 or 40 miles per hour, Ada guessed, in the seconds before the Sony carried them out of sight. But the birds were moving faster, perhaps 60 miles per hour, four times as fast as any droshky or carryall that Ada or the other three had ever ridden in. "What?" began Hannah. "Terror birds," said Savi. "Voroshakos. After the Rubicon, the Arnists had a wild few centuries of such play. It's sort of fitting, since the real terror birds wandered these plains and hills about 2 million years ago. But that kind of recombinant crap, like your dinosaurs up north, plays havoc with the ecology. The posts promised to clean it all up during the final fax hiatus, but they didn't." "What's an Arnist?" asked Ada. The animals, red-beaked terror birds and prey alike, were out of sight behind them. Larger herds with larger animals were visible now to the west, being stalked by tigerish-looking things. The Sony swung higher and turned toward the foothills. Savi sighed as if weary. RNA artists. Recombinant freelancers. Social rebels and merry pranksters with sequencers and bootleg regen tanks. She looked over at Ada, then at Harmon, then back at Demon and Hannah. "Never mind, children," she said. They flew another 15 minutes above steaming forests, and then turned west into a mountain range. Clouds moved around and between the mountain peaks below them, and snow whipped around the Sony, but somehow the force field kept the elements at bay. Savi touched a glowing image. The Sony slowed, circled, and turned west toward the late afternoon sun. They were very high. "Oh my," said Harmon. Ahead of them, two sharp peaks rose on either side of a narrow saddle covered by grassy terraces and truly ancient ruins, stone walls with no roofs. A bridge, also from the Lost Age, but obviously not as ancient as the stone ruins, ran from one of the sharp-toothed peaks to the other above the ruins. There was no road beyond the suspension bridge. The roadway ended in a wall of rock at both ends, and the foundations were sunk into rock between the ruins below. The Sony circled. "A suspension bridge," whispered Harmon. "I've read about them." Ada was good at estimating the size of things, and she guessed that the main span of this bridge was almost a mile in length, although the roadbed had broken away in a score of places, showing rusted rebar and empty air. She guessed the two towers, each showing ancient orange paint but sporting mostly rust, to be more than 700 feet tall, the top of each tower rising higher than the mountains at either end. The double towers were green with what looked to be ivy from a distance. But as the Sony circled closer, Ada could see that the growth was artificial. Green bubbles and stairways and globs of flexible glass-like material wrapping around the towers, strung along the heavy suspension cables, even trailing down the support cables and hanging free above the ruined roadway. Clouds moved down from the high peaks and mixed with the fog rising from the deep canyons below the ruins on the hilltop, curling and writhing around the south tower and obscuring the roadway and hanging cables there. "Does this place have a name?" asked Ada. "The Golden Gate at Machu Picchu," said Savi, as she touched the controls to bring them closer. "What does that mean?" asked Demon. "I have no idea," said Savi. The dust red in the bright sunlight here beyond the clouds, and floated slowly, carefully to the top of the tower, touching down without a sound. The force field died away. Savi nodded and everyone crawled out, stretched, looked around. The air was cold and very thin. Demon wandered over to the rusted edge of the tower top, leaning out to look. Growing up with Paris Crater as his home base, he had no fear of heights. "I wouldn't fall if I were you," said Savi.
There's no fermery rescue here. You die away from the fax nodes, you stay dead. Demon lurched backward, almost falling in his haste to get back from the edge. What are you talking about? Just what I said Savi, hoisting her pack to her right shoulder. There's no fax to the fermery here. Try to stay alive until you get back. Ada looked skyward to where both rings were visible through the high, thin air. I thought the post-humans could fax us from anywhere if we got into trouble. To the rings, said Savi, her voice flat. Where the fermery heals you, to where you ascend after your 5th 20 to join the post-humans. Yes, Ada said weakly. Savi shook her head. It's not the posts who fax you away when something bad happens, rebuilding you. All that's myth. Or, to be less polite, bullshit. Harmon opened his mouth to speak, but it was Demon who spoke first. I was just there, he said, anger in his voice. In the fermery, in the rings. In the fermery, yes, said Savi. But not healed by post-humans. If they're up there, they don't care a whit about you. And I don't think they're up there anymore. The four stood on the rusted tower summit more than 500 feet above the ruined roadway, 800 feet above the grassy saddle and stone ruins. Wind from the higher peaks buffeted them and blew their hair. After our last 20, we go up to join the posts, began Hannah, her voice small. Savi laughed and led the way toward an irregular glass globule blobbing up over the west end of the ancient tower top. There were rooms and anterooms and stairways descending and frozen escalators and smaller rooms off the main chambers. Ada thought it strange that the sky and the orange towers and the hanging cables and glimpses of the jungle and roadway below were not tinted green through the material, nor was the sunlight streaming in turned green. The green glass somehow passed colors accurately. Savi led them down and around from one green module to the next, from one side of the bifurcated tower to another through thin tubes that should have been swinging in the strong breeze but weren't. Some of the chambers extended 30 or 40 feet out beyond the tower, and Ada had no clue how the green globule was attached to the concrete and steel. Some of the rooms were empty. Others had artifacts. A series of animal skeletons stood silhouetted against the mountain skyline in one room. In another, what appeared to be replicas of machines lined display counters and hung from wires. In yet another, plexiglass cubes held fetuses of 100 creatures, none of them human, but some disturbingly close to human. In another room, faded holograms of star fields and ring fields moved over and through the observers. What is this place? Asked Harmon. A sort of museum, said Savi. I think most of the important displays are missing. Created by whom? Asked Hannah. Savi shrugged. Not by the posts, I think. I don't know. But I'm pretty sure that the bridge, or the original of this bridge, it may be a replica, once stood above water near a lost age city on what was then the west coast of the continent north of here. Have you heard of such a thing, Harmon? No. Perhaps I dreamt it, said Savi with a rueful laugh. My memory plays tricks on me after all these centuries of sleep. You mentioned sleeping through the centuries once before, Demon said, his tone sounding brusque to Ada. What are you talking about? Savi had led them down a long spiral staircase in the green glass tube strung between the suspension cables, and now she gestured to a line of what appeared to be crystal coffins. A form of cryosleep, she said, only not cold, which is silly because that's what cryo meant originally. Some of these cocoons still work, still freeze molecular motion, not through cold but through some microtechnology that draws power from the bridge. From the bridge? Said Ada. The whole thing is a solar power receiver, said Savi, or at least the green parts are. Ada looked at the dusty crystal coffins and tried to imagine going to sleep in one and waiting, what, years before waking, decades, centuries? She shuddered. Savi was looking at her, and Ada blushed, but Savi smiled, one of her sincerely amused smiles, Ada thought. They climbed to a long green glass cylinder hanging from a frayed and rusted support cable that was thicker than Harmon was tall.
Ada found herself treading softly, trying to lift her weight by sheer will, afraid that their combined weight would bring the cylinder down, the cable, the whole bridge. Again, she caught Savi watching her. This time, Ada did not blush, but frowned back, tired of the old woman's scrutiny. All four of them stopped a minute, alarmed. It appeared that they had walked into a meeting hall filled with people, people standing along the edges of the room, men and women in weird garb, people sitting at desks and standing at control panels, people who did not move or turn their gazes in the direction of the newcomers. "They're not real," said Demon, walking to the nearest man, dressed in a dusty blue suit with some sort of fabric at his throat, and touching the figure's face. The five walked from figure to figure, staring at the men and women dressed in odd clothes, people with strangely patterned hair and unusual personal adornment. Tattoos, strange jewelry, dyed hair and skin. "I read that once servitors came in the shape of human beings," began Harmon.
"No," said Savi. "These aren't robots, only mannequins."
"What?" said Demon. Savi explained the word.
"Do you know who they're supposed to be?" asked Hannah. "Or why they're here?"
"No," said Savi. She stood back while the others explored. At the end of the chamber, set in a glass alcove as if in pride of place, the figure of a man was posed in an ornate wood and leather slung chair. Even seen sitting, it was obvious that this figure was shorter than most of the other male mannequins in the hall, and dressed in some sort of tan tunic that looked like a short, belted dress made out of rough cotton or wool. The figure's feet were shod with sandals. The short man could have been comic, but his features, short, curly gray hair, hawk nose, and fierce gray eyes staring out boldly from under heavy brows, were so powerful that Ada found herself approaching the mannequin warily. The man's forearms were shaped with such muscle and so many scars, the stubby fingers were curled easily, but with much strength on the wooden arms of the camp chair. Everything about the carved form gave an impression of such coiled strength, of will as well as body, that Ada stopped 6 feet away from it. The man was visibly older than humans chose to look in this age, somewhere between Harmon's second 20 and Savi's old age. The man's tunic hung low enough that Ada could see the graying hair on his broad bronzed chest. Demon hurried forward. "I know this man," he said, pointing. "I've seen him before."
"From the Turin drama," said Hannah.
"Yes, yes," said Demon, snapping his fingers in an attempt to remember. "His name is..."
"Odysseus," said the man in the chair. He stood and took a step toward the startled Demon. "Odysseus, son of Laertes."
17. Mars.
"She's stabilizing," said Monmouth over the hard-lined Orfu. "Roll rate down to about one revolution every 6 seconds. Pitch and yaw are approaching zero."
"I'm going to try to flatten out the roll," said Orfu. "Tell me when you have the polar cap in the reticule."
"Okay, no. It's drifting."
"Damn, what a mess."
End of side 5.